What if I told you the most important primary result you could watch for tonight, Super Tuesday, doesn't have anything to do with Donald Trump or Joe Biden, that it is not in a swing state, that instead, the candidate to keep your eye on is a Republican in California with no chance of winning? This guy's name is Steve Garvey.
So, Alex, how absurd is Steve Garvey as a candidate for Senate?
Slate's Alex Salmon has been covering his campaign.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a list of people who think that Steve Garvey could be the senator from California, Steve Garvey is not on it.
Garvey is running for Dianne Feinstein's old seat in a contest where the top two candidates are going to face off again in the fall. And he's competing against a murderer's row of Democratic politicians. People like congressional leader Adam Schiff, progressive favorite Katie Porter, and activist firebrand Barbara Lee.
Steve Garvey, the batter here in the bottom of the ninth.
Garvey's not a politician, though.
A long drive to deep left.
He is a baseball player, a former first baseman for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
And that's not all. Steve Garvey proved to be one of the nicest, most courteous men in sports, a man whose clean image gave baseball a better name.
Back in the 80s, he was also notorious for fathering kids with two different women over the course of 1 year, while marrying a third. A San Diego radio station even made bumper stickers that said, "Honk if you're carrying Steve Garvey's baby." Anyway, you can see why he's not exactly a shoo-in for Senate. But he's got some more basic problems, too.
Where to begin? Doesn't have any money, for one thing. I mean, I think that the last fundraising report that we saw from him, he had $300,000.
Whoa. That's like a fraction of what his Democratic rivals have?
Yeah, Schiff's got upwards of $30 million, so less than 1/100th of what Schiff has got, which is, you know, just a small part of how unserious he is. There's no platform. There's no policies.
It's not like no one has noticed this unseriousness. In fact, at a candidate debate a few weeks back, Steve Garvey was asked about his lack of experience directly. He did not have much of an answer.
Mr. Garvey, you've never served an elected office. And you said you don't plan on giving specifics about policy until after the primary. Why did you get into this race if you don't know where you stand on these issues? And how can Californians know what they're getting if they pick you?
I have said that I'm new. I needed to explore California. I needed to talk to the people. I needed to hear from them, their feelings about their elected officials. And that's what I've done.
And there is emphatically no way that he will actually win.
So why does he matter?
Well, he matters actually quite a lot now. He has a very central role in this race all of a sudden. There's polling that came out Friday morning before Election Day in California that has Garvey leading the pack.
Leading all of the candidates?
Yes, leading all of the candidates.
Today on the show, the very strange story of how Democrats' choices are empowering a Republican spoiler in one of the bluest states in the country. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip. cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Republican Steve Garvey's success as a candidate would not have been possible without California's unusual primary system. It's called a jungle primary. And what it means is the top two vote-getters tonight will head to a runoff in November, regardless of their party. It's not Democrat versus Republican. It's everyone versus everyone. Alex says all the Democrats in this race, they want to make their job easier come November. And a guy like Steve Garvey, he's pretty easy to campaign against. In fact, Alex says, you cannot explain Steve Garvey's success without naming someone else.
It's basically impossible to say without saying the words Adam Schiff. And that's because Adam Schiff is basically running his campaign for him and running it in a spectacular, spectacular fashion. Garvey can't afford to get on TV, not with $300,000. You know, it's he's not doing that. But if you're in California right now, all you're seeing is Steve Garvey ads. You might be seeing some Adam Schiff, but you're definitely seeing Steve Garvey. And that's courtesy of Adam Schiff.
Steve Garvey, the leading Republican, is too conservative for California. He voted for Trump twice and supported Republicans for years, including far-right conservatives.
Like to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, basically, of primetime television ads, of mailers, of an incredibly advanced Republican get out the vote campaign. It's a shadow campaign run by the Schiff people, and it's pretty impressive.
Okay, let's explain how he got to the point where this unprepared fringe Republican candidate is actually having an impact on this Senate race in True Blue, California. And I wonder if we should just really go back to the beginning and just talk about why there's a Senate race in the first place. This is Dianne Feinstein's seat.
Right, right. Yeah, so this brings it all back to the drama of last year in the Senate, the great drama of Dianne Feinstein's very public demise. Which is important because it does really set the stage for the sort of strange dysfunction of her succession. This is that seat. It was filled briefly by Gavin Newsom with a placeholder, LaFonza Butler, who you and I have talked about not long ago. Mm-hmm. And she has quietly filled that role for a couple of months and is now departing, in effect. And who will replace her, obviously, is hotly contested. California has gotten much, much bluer. It's gotten much more progressive. It's a one-party state now. It's a Democratic state through and through.
So who is the first person to announce they intended to run for this seat?
It got sort of contentious right away, right? Because Katie Porter, who's a congresswoman from Orange County.
Law professor,
Elizabeth Warren, understudy, relative neophyte in California political years, which, you know, it's so hard to get a promotion as a California Democrat because, again, one-party state. There's a lot of political talent. Everybody wants to move up, and there's not that many spots to move up into. Porter declared before Feinstein said that she would not seek re-election. It sounds hilarious to say that now, but that was the sort of decorum that was expected, was to wait until Feinstein declared whether she would run for re-election again in 24.
Hold on. Why was that a problem?
It was a problem because Porter already doesn't have a lot of friends in California. And she's sort of known Nancy Pelosi doesn't like her very much, that we sort of know well that the two of them have disagreed on things publicly. The perception that she was maybe cutting the line didn't sit that well.
Like, there was no way for her to announce she was interested in this job without getting an eye roll from leadership.
I don't think there was a delicate way to do it. Yeah.
All right. Okay, so Katie Porter announces she's in the race. What happens after that?
After that, Adam Schiff announces that he is going in to throw his hat in the ring.
Adam Schiff, of course, like a major Pelosi ally, led the impeachment proceedings.
Absolutely, right. One of Pelosi's closest allies. He also announces, because he gets nervous that Porter's getting a head start with the fundraising. Pelosi sort of jumps in after him and says, if Dianne wants to run again, I endorse her. But if she does not want to run again, I endorse Schiff, which was very notable because it's rare to see leadership jump in an open primary like that. You know, they're supposed to love all their children equally, sort of. and then Barbara Lee came in after that, congresswoman from Oakland.
Progressive, known for protesting the Iraq War, known for taking a lot of stands that have made her counter to leadership.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of brave and lonely stands over the years. Someone who's very close with the activist class in California, a very particular sort of progressive left-wing grassroots political orientation. She actually waited until Feinstein announced that she was stepping aside to jump in. So she was the only one who waited that long, and the reward for doing that obviously was zero.
I mean, it's interesting to look at this field of candidates because it's a real variety pack. You know what I mean? It's like you've got an activist. You've got this kind of Elizabeth Warren protege in Porter. She's known for getting on the House floor with like charts. That's her jam. And then you've got the moderate, you know, sort of solid leadership guy with Schiff. And I actually think that's an interesting group of people to be competing against each other because it forces you to really like decide what color is my parachute or whatever.
Right. It's actually the sort of the perfect Democratic contest because it is these three schools of Democratic thought in a lot of ways. You have, right, you have the activist, you have the technocrat, and you have the fundraiser is sort of, I think, how you would handicap the three of those. And they all exist under this big blue tent, right? But they have very, very different priorities, very different styles of governance, very different styles of campaigning. And it's sort of ideal, actually, that like California, the most Democratic state, would have these three representatives of the three different types of Democratic politics, and they would decide, you know, which one do we want to represent us in the Senate? What do we want at the top of the ticket?
These three Democrats may be different shades of blue, but Alex says there is one way in which Schiff the technocrat stands out.
You know, the big difference really in this field, Porter and Lee, very progressive, right? Medicare for all, Green New Deal, sort of you go down the list of progressive policies, they embrace pretty much all of them. Schiff is not like that. Schiff has a long career of being one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress. He was a former blue dog, which is the, you know, the caucus group that is the most conservative. He was talking about entitlement reform and spending cuts well into the Obama years. Like, this is not a progressive, just to be clear, not at all. The second he threw his hat in the ring for the Senate, he immediately said, I support Medicare for all. I support the Green New Deal. I have a lifelong voting record on progressive issues, and it speaks for itself. And he tried actually to get into the progressive caucus in Washington, which, you know, has been around for a long time. Schiff has never shown any interest in being in it in his entire congressional career. He tries to apply, and he actually gets rejected because, like everyone else, the Progressive Caucus is well aware that Schiff is not a progressive and has no progressive bona fides.
Technically, Schiff withdrew his application before he was ever officially rejected. But Alex's point still stands. I did press Alex a little, though, about why Schiff's late turn to the left comes off as disingenuous.
Isn't this what a progressive wants Schiff to do? Like, change his mind?
Yes, I think that there is a very strong case that this is a huge triumph for the progressive movement in California. But I think that when you're talking about, you know, picking a senator, you sort of want that senator to deserve the promotion, right? And I think that there are candidates in this field who have fought for these things when they were less popular, who have stood by these things for years and years, and who have actually proven that they will fight for them in Washington upon arrival. It's a little bit ridiculous to say that you would be confident that Schiff will do that if he shows up in the Senate.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I want to talk about Adam Schiff's strategy of boosting Steve Garvey, the Republican, as an opponent, because I think that is tied in with how you feel about Schiff's move to the left. Because my understanding, having read your work, is that part of what gets you is that if Adam Schiff was truly moving to the left, he'd want to talk about those issues. He'd want to, like, hash it out. But instead, what it seems like he wants to do is battle Steve Garvey, who he's elevating and painting as a sort of MAGA guy, even though it's unclear where Steve Garvey stands on MAGA.
Right. Yeah. The thing that he's doing that I think is a little irksome, maybe, from my perspective, and I think probably from the perspective of many Democrats, is he's sort of like shadow boxing a candidate who doesn't exist in Steve Garvey. He realized that if he goes to the top two against a Republican, it's guaranteed that he's going to win. It doesn't matter what he believes. Doesn't matter what his track record is. None of this matters. All that matters is that there's an R and there's a D, and a D will always win in California statewide. So he figured out that if he can boost Garvey into that top two finish, he doesn't have to answer for his record. He doesn't have to do any sort of debate. He doesn't have to grapple with the legacy. And, you know, the job is done if he can get Garvey across the finish line onto this podium. There was polling, it's still out there, that shows that Katie Porter head-to-head against Schiff does very well. Like, she wants that matchup.
Oh, like she does well.
Yeah, yeah. That if it's the two of them, that she'll beat him. I think that her campaign believes that. They've got polling that says that. Schiff has to be aware of that polling too, right? I'm sure he knows that's a tough fight. That's a real, meaningful, difficult fight for him. Running against Steve Garvey is a cakewalk. And so they figured out, all right, let's get Garvey's name out there. Let's get him on the airwaves. Let's get him on tons of TV ads. We'll put him up in a way that you know, sort of speaks to a conservative consciousness, say that, you know, Garvey is too conservative for California, and then list all these great traits of his, which is how these ads go. And then say at the very end, like, Adam Schiff for Senate.
It's a funny approach because it's like, it is technically an Adam Schiff ad, but it just puts out in your consciousness that this guy exists, the Steve Garvey guy,
right,
and that he's conservative. And so if you're conservative, it might ring a bell in your brain like, oh, hmm. And then Adam Schiff has also done mailers to Republican voters, right?
Right, right. So they have this pretty advanced, I think, this mailer program where they're doing outreach to high propensity Republican voters.
They're presented, it's like, here are your choices, Adam Schiff or Steve Garvey, which isn't true because there are other people in the race, first of all. And it sort of presents them as, you know, here's what Adam Schiff believes, here's what Steve Garvey believes. And it says, the choice is clear, and it has both of their names. And Adam Schiff has a green check mark by him, and Steve Garvey has a red X mark by him, but they're both like checking a box as if you could be voting for them.
Right.
So it's very ambiguous. It's like, the choice is clear, these two men. And you're like, and so it leaves room that, like, this could be a mailer for anyone unless you really look at it closely.
Right, totally. And if you look at the way that they, like, describe Garvey, it's like this beautiful airbrush photo of Steve Garvey, and it says, like, philanthropist and, like, you know, baseball player. You know, it's like, it's not like, you know, they're not going through his worst traits. Like, they're going through a condensed version of his CV with all the good stuff. And the crazy thing is that we've already seen early returns on these ballots, and polling stuff has shown that the electorate for this race looks much more conservative than usual. It looks much older. It looks much more conservative. So we know that it's working. And it's working in no small part because Schiff has $30 million to spend on it. And that's what he's doing. It's a fair tactic. I mean, it's something that has worked for Democrats in the past. And I think the critical distinction here is that it's swing states and swing districts and stuff where we've seen this be effective, right? Where they've intervened to, like, elevate a far right Republican candidate who couldn't, you know, is less likely to win in a general election, as opposed to, like, a more moderate Republican who maybe would beat a Democrat in a general election. But I think that in those cases, it was being used to benefit the party broadly. And I think in this case, it's very hard to say that this is being done for the benefit of the party. It's actually probably hurting the party down the ballot.
Yeah, tell me more about that, because you've argued that. You've argued that come November, Democrats may really regret this choice because of the down ballot effect.
Right. It's just interesting because, you know, Schiff is supposedly, you know, team player or whatever. He's Pelosi's friend and he's been in the House forever. So you think he's, you know, there's probably some consciousness of what's going on in the House. And what's going on in the House is, of course, that there are a bunch of districts in California that Republicans narrowly won in 22 that Democrats really want to win in 24. And because of this jungle primary system and because of the top two go to the, you know, to the runoff, no matter what their party affiliation is, there are numerous districts where Democrats want to win. They want to flip the district and they may well get shut out of the top two altogether. There are districts like California's 22nd district. Democrats are biting their nails and they might get locked out there and there'll be two Republicans there. 47 is Katie Porter's old district. It's one that Republicans are trying to flip from blue back to red. There are a number, numerous districts where, you know, juicing Republican turnout could have a huge impact. And with all that in mind, running a campaign that's basically a Republican turnout campaign, which is what the Schiff campaign has become, is not being done for the good of the party.
I see a slightly different problem than you do with this approach, but it's related, and I want to talk to you about it, which is when I look at this Democratic technique of boosting Republicans so the Democrats can win more easily, I see how it can contribute to making the Republican Party more extreme. And I say that because I'm thinking about one race in particular. Last year, Peter Meyer in Michigan, he was a pretty moderate Republican. He voted to impeach Donald Trump. But the Democrats used this technique against him, like painted him as MAGA. He lost his seat. Democrats won it. So yay, I guess, for them. But now Meyer's running for Senate in Michigan, and he's basically saying, like, Trump's fine as a candidate because he doesn't see a home for himself working, quote unquote, across the aisle. It seems like he's spoken very strongly about, like, the kind of cynicism on the Democratic side. He clearly feels like he got knifed in the back.
Totally. And it just sort of, like, it just sort of deprives voters of a real choice, I think, in some ways. You know, it's one of these things where, yes, it's good to act strategically. That makes perfect sense. But also, yeah, there are consequences of these things. And you know, if you aren't putting out an affirmative message of, like, what you believe in and why people should vote for you, you can only get so much mileage out of, oh, this guy is, you know, so extreme and whatever. And we've seen the way that the Republican Party has been willing to accommodate extremeness.
What are you going to be looking for on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning to kind of understand what the results mean? Is there a metric you have?
The funny thing is about, they're all going to be pretty low numbers, right? It's a very crowded field. So is any candidate going to get even 30%? I doubt it. And if it's, you know, Schiff and Garvey in the 20s and, you know, Barbara Lee in the 10s and Katie Porter in the teens, I mean, you know, Porter is a rising star in Democratic politics, right? You'd have to say that. She's really one of the great young talents that the party has. If she doesn't even make the runoff, what happens to her political career? You know, she's not.
Yeah, she out after that? She's out of Congress?
Yeah, out of Congress. I mean, I've heard maybe that she would consider running for governor, but, like, it's not a great way to run a party. And that's the problem with this sort of gerontocracy of the Democratic Party nationally, is that these young, talented up-and-comers, there's nowhere for them to go because the old guard won't step aside. And then what happens to them? I mean, it's unfortunate. And I don't know if Katie Porter gets distant third, what she does next, I couldn't tell you.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, Adam Schiff isn't old. Adam Schiff is certainly, he can do the job. He's just allied with the party machine.
Right, right. He's just, Schiff is the ultimate replacement level politician, I think. And I, you know, as someone who follows the party really closely, I know that the leadership is very powerful, that the moderate forces inside of leadership are very powerful, and it's hard for progressives to thrive in that environment because they face internal opposition. That's what we're seeing here. I think that for me, what it really shows is how hard it is to turn over a new leaf. And, like, a lot of what we thought with Feinstein dying and being so old and, you know, Pelosi sort of stepping aside and letting Hakeem Jeffries take over is, like, we're sort of turning the page with this new generation of leadership. And it's like that, it's really hard for that to happen. That doesn't happen on its own, and it doesn't happen without a lot of pushing. And so we're supposedly seeing a turning of the page here. And in a very real way, it's not happening at all.
Alex Salmon, I'm super grateful for your time. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mary.
Alex Salmon writes about politics here at Slate. And that's our show. If you are a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. That is our membership program. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. You can go track me down on Twitter. I'm at Mary's Desk. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.